not look at him. Staring at Karpel, I said, "If he speaks again without me knowing who he is, I will throw him out of the window, and I won't open it first." "This is Chesna Fischig of the Adeptus Arbites. I wanted him present." Now I looked at the man in brown. He was a heavy-set brute with a loop of shiny pink scar tissue under one milky eye. I'd taken him to be a young man with his clean skin and blonde hair, but now I studied him, I saw he was at least my age. "Chesna," I nodded.
"Inquisitor," he returned, "my question stands."
I sat back in my chair. Merdin Eichlone was a facilitator. A brilliant, devious man, one of the most dangerous I have ever hunted. Sometimes to hunt down your prey is to finish his evil. I'm sure you have experience of that.
"You called him a facilitator."
"That was where his danger lay. He believed he could serve his obscene masters best by offering his considerable skills to cults and sects that needed them. He had no true allegiances. He worked to facilitate the grand schemes of others. What he was doing here on Hubris was to advance and develop someone else's plans. Now he is dead, and his scheme thwarted. We may be thankful, but my task is not done. I must work back from Eichlone, his men, from any clue he left, and dig my way into whatever greater secret darkness was employing him."
"And for this you want the cooperation of the people of Hubris?" asked Karpel.
"The people? The authorities? You? Everyone? This is the Emperor's work. Will you shrink from it?"
"No, sir, I will not," snapped Karpel.
"Excellent." Karpel tossed a gold solar form badge to me. It was heavy and old, mounted on a pad of black leather.
"This will give you authority, my authority. Conduct your work thoroughly and quickly. I ask two things in return.
And they are?
You report all findings to me, and you allow the Chastener to accompany you.
I work my own way. Fischig can open doors and voice boxes here in the Sun Dome that even that badge may not.
Consider him a local guide."
"And your ears and eyes," I thought. But I knew he was under immense pressure from the nobility to produce results, so I said, "I will be grateful for his assistance."
"Where first?"
Fischig asked. Down to business at once, a hungry look on his face. They want blood, I realized. They want someone to punish for the deaths, someone they could say they caught, or at least helped to catch. They want to share in whatever successes I have so that they can look good when the rest of their population wakes up to this disaster in a few months' time. I couldn't blame them. "First," I said, "the mortuary." Eichlone looked as if he was asleep. His head had been wrapped in an almost comical plastic bonnet to contain the wound I had dealt him. Framed in the plastic, his face was tranquil, with just a slight bruising around the lips. He lay on a stone plinth in the chill of the morgue below RBT's Mortuary 1. His brethren lay on numbered plinths around him, those that had been recovered more or less intact. There were labelled bins of mostly liquescent material against the back wall, the remains of those that Betancourt had slaughtered with the cutter's cannons. The air in the underground vault was lit cold blue, and frost-covered circulators pumped in sub-zero air directly from the ice desert outside the Sun Dome. Fischig had provided us all with heat gowns for the visit. I was impressed by what I saw. Both the dutiful care and attention that had been used to sequester and store the bodies, and by the fact that no one had touched them, according to my instructions. It seems a simple command to give, but I have lost count of the times that over-eager death priests or surgeons have begun autopsies before I arrived. The mortician superintendent was a haggard woman in her 60s called Teutrone. She attended us in red plastic scrubs worn over an old and threadbare heat gown. Mortress Teutrone had a bionic implant in one eye socket, and blades and bone-saw manipulators of gleaming surgical steel built into her right hand. "I have done as you instructed," she told me as she led us down the spiral steps into the cold vault. "But it is irregular. Rules state I must begin examinations, prelim examinations at least, as soon as possible." "I thank you for your diligence, Mortress. I will be done quickly. Then you can follow protocol." Pulling on surgical gloves, I moved through the lines of dead. There were nearly 20 of them, dictating observations to Amos. There was virtually nothing to be learned from the men. Some, I gauged from build and coloration, to be off-worlders, but they had no documents, no surgical identifiers, no clue whatsoever about their origins or identities. Even their clothing was blank. Manufacturing tags and labels had been torn or burned off. I could begin a forensic investigation to identify the source of the clothing, but that would be a massive waste of resources. On two of them, I found fresh scars that suggested subcutaneous ident markers had been surgically removed. Ident marking was not a local practice, so that at least suggested off-world. But where? Hundreds of Imperial planets routinely used such devices, and their placing and use was pretty standard. I had carried one myself for a few years as a child, before the black ship selected me, and it was dug out. One of the corpses had a curious scarring on the forearms, not deep, but thorough, searing the epidermis.
"Someone has used a melter torch to remove gang tattoos," Amos said.
He was right. Again, it was tantalizingly incomplete. I looked at Eiklone, where I thought my best bet lay. With the mortress's help, I cut away his clothes, all of which were as anonymous as his followers' garb. We turned his naked corpse, looking for, well, anything.
"There,"
Fischig said, leaning in, "a brand mark above the left buttock.
The Seraph of Loacus. An old chaos mark.
Eiklone had it done to honour his then-masters 20 years ago. A previous cult. A previous employer. Nothing to do with this." Fischig looked at me curiously.
"You know the details of his naked flesh?"
"I have sources," I replied. I didn't want to have to tell the tale. Imander, one of my first companions, brilliant, beautiful, and bold. She had found that detail out for me. She had been in an asylum now for 5 years. The last report I had received said she had eaten away her own fingers.
"But he marks himself," Fischig added. "With each new cult he involves himself in, he carries their mark to show his allegiance."
The man had a point, damn him. We looked. At least 6 laser scars on his body seemed likely to have been previous cult marks, burned off after he left those associations. Behind his left ear, a skin inlay of silver was worked in the form of the Bubo Chaotica.
"This?"
asked Teutrone, shaving the hair aside with her finger blades to reveal it.
"Old, as before."
I stepped back from the body and thought hard. When I'd killed him, he had been reaching for something on his belt, or so it had seemed to me. His effects. They were laid out on a metal tray nearby. His las pistol, a compact vox device, a pearl inlaid box containing 6 obscura tubes and an igniter, a credit tile, spare cells for the gun, a plastic key, and the belt, with 4 buttoned pouches. I opened them one by one, some local coins, a miniature las knife, 3 bars of high-calorie rations, a steel toothpick, more obscura, this time in an injector vial, a small data slate. At the moment of death, which of these things had he been reaching for? The knife? Too slow and small to counter a man who has a naval pistol wedged into your mouth. Then again, he was desperate, and then again, he hadn't reached for his holstered las gun. The data slate, perhaps. I picked it up and activated it, but it needed a cipher to gain access. All manner of secrets might be locked inside. But why would a man reach for a data slate in the face of certain death?
"Track marks along the forearm," Teutrone stated, continuing her exam.
Hardly surprising, given the narco wear we'd recovered from him. "No rings, no bracelets, earrings, piercing studs?"
"None."
I pulled a plastic pouch from a dispenser on the surgical cart and put all his effects into it.
"You will sign for those, won't you?"
Teutrone asked, looking up. "Of course."
"You hated him, didn't you?"
Fischig said suddenly.
"What?"
He leaned back against a plinth, crossing his arms.
"You had him at your mercy, and you knew his head was full of secrets, but you emptied it with your gun. I have no compunction when it comes to killing, but I know when I'm wasting a lead. Was it rage?"
"I'm an inquisitor," I do not get angry.
Then what?
I had just about enough of his snide tone. You don't know how dangerous this man is. I wasn't taking chances.
He looks safe enough to me,
Fischig smirked, looking down at the body. Here's something, Teutrone called out. We all moved in. She was working on his left hand, delicately, with her finest gauge scalpels and probes, her augmented fingers darting like a seamstress. The index finger of the left hand. There's unusual lividity and swelling. She played a small scanner across it. The nail ceramite, artificial. An implant. What's inside?
Unknown. A ghost reading. There's maybe... Ah, there it is. A catch under the quick. You'll need something small to trigger it.
She adjusted her bionic finger settings and slid out a very thin metal probe. Thin like... a toothpick.
Back now, I yelled.
It was too late. Teutrone had undone the catch. The false nail sprang back, and something flew out of the cavity in the fingertip. A silver worm, like a thread of necklace chain, flashed through the air.
Where did it go?
I don't know, I said, pushing Teutrone and Amos behind me. Did you see it? Asked Fischig.
Over there, he said,
pulling a short-nosed, gloss-black auto-pistol out from his robes. I reached for my own gun, then remembered I'd given it back to Vibben. I snatched up a bone knife from the trolley. The worm slithered back into the light. It was a meter long and several centimeters thick now. What foul sorcery had caused that expansion, I did not want to know. It was made of segmented metal, and the head was an eyeless cone, split by a hissing mouth full of razor teeth. Teutrone cried out as it flew at us. I pushed her down, and the thing whipped across over us, hitting a corpse on a nearby plinth. There was a dreadful sucking, gnawing sound, and the worm disappeared into the corpse's torso through a jagged hole. The corpse vibrated and ruptured, filling the air with a foul mist of vapour. The worm swished up out of it and disappeared across the floor. By then, Fischig had opened fire and blasted the shattered corpse off its plinth. The worm was long since gone.
"Touch activated mechanism," Amos was murmuring to himself. "Very discreet, probably of Xenos manufacture, a guard weapon with some mass-altering system that expands it on contact with air and or release, hunting by sound."
"So shut up," I told him. I bundled him and Teutrone against the far wall. Fischig and I moved in parallel courses down through the plinth rows, weapons ready. It reappeared. By the time I saw it, it was almost on me, thrashing forward through the air on its metallic tail. In a split second, I reflected that this was how Eiklone had wanted me to die. This was what he had intended to unleash against me on the landing platform at Processional 212. Rage made me deny him. I stabbed out, and my extended blade jabbed directly between the gaping teeth and down the gullet. The impact knocked me back. I found I had the whole heavy 2-meter thing thrashing on the end of my knife like a lash. Shots banged past me. Fischig was trying to hit it. "You'll kill me, you idiot! Hold it still!" With a metallic rasping, it was chewing down the blade and the handle towards my hand. Teutrone came in from behind me, and together we wrestled the powerful, coiling thing onto a plinth. She activated a bone saw on her augmetic hand and sliced down through its neck with a shrill scream of spinning blades. The body continued to thrash. She grabbed it and dropped it into an acid trough, usually reserved for bio-waste. The hissing head and the knife it was still chewing away at quickly followed it. The four of us gazed down at the thrashing remains as they disintegrated. I looked round at Mortress, Teutrone, and Fischig.
"I know which one of you I'd rather have around in a fight," I muttered.
Teutrone laughed. Fischig didn't.
"What was it?"
Amos asked me as we raced in Fischig's landspeeder through the streets to the RBT's headquarters.
"You guessed more than I know," I replied. "A gift from his masters, certainly."
"What manner of masters makes a thing like that?"
"Powerful ones, Amos. The worst kind." Our meeting at the RBT's grim chambers was brief. At my request, Fischig had summoned Magus Palastomes, the head of the cryogenerator Techno Magi. He took one look at the casket in the evidence room and said,
"I have no idea what that is."
"Thank you. That will be all," I told him. I turned to Fischig. "Have this sent immediately to my vessel."
"It is state's evidence," he began.
Who do you work for, Fishig?
The Emperor.
Then pretend I'm him, and you won't be far wrong. Do it! Hayden Bonds was waiting for us in the interrogation room. He had been stripped naked, but Fishig assured me nothing of import had been found in his clothes. Bonds was the gunman I had laid out in the cryogenerator chamber, the only one of Eichlone's men to have survived the night. His mouth was swollen from my blow. He had admitted nothing except his name. Fishig, Amos, and I entered the room, a dull stone box. Bonds was shackled to a metal chair and looked terrified. So should he, I thought. "Tell me about Merdin Eichlone," I said.
"Who?"
The darkness had gone from his eyes now. Eichlone's spell broken. He was bewildered and confused.
"Then tell me the last thing you remember."
"I was on Thracian Primaris. That was my home. I was a stevedore in the docks. I remember going to a bar with a friend. That is all."
"The friend?"
"A dockmaster called Wyn Edon. We got drunk, I think."
"Did Edon mention an Eichlone?"
"No. Look, where am I? These bastards won't say. What am I supposed to have done?"
I smiled. "You tried to kill me for a start."
"You?"
"I'm an Imperial Inquisitor." At that, terror made him lose control of his body functions. He began pleading, begging, telling us all sorts of misdemeanors, none of which mattered. I knew from the first moments that he was useless. Just a mesmerized slave, chosen for his muscle, knowing nothing. But we spent 2 hours with him anyway. Fishig slowly turned a wall dial near the door that vented in increasing measures of the sub-zero air outside the sun dome. In our heat gowns, we asked questions over and again. When Bonds's flesh began to adhere to the metal chair, we knew there was nothing more.
"Warm him up and feed him well," Fishig told his men as we left the cell. "We execute him at dawn."
I didn't ask if that meant some arbitrary time in the next cycle, or real dawn, 6 months away, at the start of thaw. I didn't much care. Fishig left us to our own devices for a while, and I ate lunch with Amos at a public bistro almost directly under the sun dome. The food was sour, rehashed from freeze-dried consumables, but at least it was hot. Fountain banks projected walls of water around the edges of the bistro so that the sun-globe light made rainbows that crisscrossed the tables and aisles. On this somber day of mourning, there were no other diners present. Amos was in good spirits. He chatted away, making connections I hadn't begun to see. For all his faults, he possessed a superb mind. Every hour I spent with him, I learned more techniques. He was forking up fish and rice and reviewing his data slate.
"Let's look at the transmission lag that Loewing detected in the messages Eichlone sent and received while on the planet."
"They're all in cipher. Loewing hasn't unlocked them yet."
"Yes, yes, but look at the lag. This one, 8 seconds. That's from a ship in orbit. And the time frame matches that period in which we know Eichlone's mysterious starship was here. But this, during your struggle with him last night, a lag of 12.5 minutes. That's from another system."
I stopped trying to macerate a lump of meat that resembled a slug and peered over. I'd never much considered the blurry sidebar that edged all astropathic message forms before. 12.5. You're sure?
I had Loewing check.
So that gives us a reference frame. He smiled. Pleased. I was pleased.
3 worlds in the picture, all between 11 and 15 minutes lag of here. Thracian Primaris, Cobalt II, and Gudrun.
Thracian Primaris was no surprise. That had been our last port of call, our last sighting of Eichlone. And as far as we knew from the wretched Bonds, the place where he had recruited some or all of his servants.
"Cobalt's a nothing," I checked. "Just an Imperial watch station, but Gudrun."
"A primary trade world. Old culture, old families."
"Old poisons,"
he finished with a laugh, completing the proverb. I dabbed my mouth with a napkin. "Can we be more certain?"
"Loewing's researching for me. Once we break the cipher,
I don't mean the message cipher itself. I mean the coded headers to the actual text. We'll know.
Gudrun, I pondered.
My Voxlink chimed in my ear. It was Betancourt.
Ever hear of a thing called the Pontius?
No, why?
I haven't either, but Loing's cracking some of the old transcripts. In the weeks before Eichlone arrived, someone was sending messages off the approved links to a location in the Sundome. They talk about the delivery of the Pontius. It's all rather vague and indirect.
Do you have a location?
Why else do you employ us? Thorview 12011, on the west side of the dome. The high-rent quarter. Aristo turf.
Any names?
No, they're very exclusive and coy about such things.
We're on it. Amos and I rose from the table. We turned to find Fischig standing there. He was wearing the full flak armor, carapace, and visored helm of an Arbetes now. I have to admit the effect was impressive.
Going somewhere without me, Inquisitor?
Going to find you, actually. Take us to Thorview. Chapter 4 The Sundome toured at speed. Thorview, 12011. Questioning Saemon Croats. The wealthiest Hubrites kept winter palaces on the west perimeter of the Sundome. According to Chasna Fischig, they enjoyed both light and dark, as if that was something indulgent. They looked inwards to the lit dome and had shutters that could be opened to view the dark landscape of the winter desert. It was a spiritual thing, Amos suggested. Fischig shut down his terrain-following guidance as we sliced through the streets, and his heavy speeder rose up above the traffic and buildings. We hooked hard turns between glass spires and roared west. I think he was showing off. In the rear seating, under the roll bars, Amos clung on and closed his eyes with a soft groan. I rode up front with the armoured Fischig, seeing a predatory grin on his face under the visor of his RBT's helmet. The speeder was a standard Imperial model, painted matte brown and sporting the badges of the solar symbol and the chevrons and tail number of the local Arbetes. Armoured, it turned heavily, the anti-grav straining to keep us aloft. There was a heavy bolter, pintle-mounted, forward of my seat. I glanced around and saw a locked rack of combat shotguns behind the rear seats.
"Give me one of those!" I yelled above the slipstream and the choppy thrum of the turbofans.
"What?
I need a weapon!"
Fischig nodded and keyed a security code into a pad built into his bulky control stick. The cage on the gun rack popped.
"Take one!"
Amos handed one over to me, and I began loading shells. Thorview rose before us, a terrace of luxurious crystal glass and ferrocrete dwellings built into the curve of the dome itself. We whipped low over stepped gardens, making ferns and palms shudder in our downwash. Then Fischig keyed the fans to idle, and we settled on a wide veranda deck, 8 stories up. He leapt out, racking his shotgun. I followed him.
"Stay here," I told Amos.
He needed no further encouragement.
"Which one?"
Fischig asked.
12011.
We edged along the wide, curving deck, clambering over dividing rails and trellises of climbing flowers. 12011 was glass-fronted, with wide sliding doors of mirrored window plate. Fischig swept up a warning hand and took a coin from his pocket. He flipped it onto the terrace, and it was atomized by 9 separate las beams. He keyed his vox.
"Chasna Fischig to RBT's control. Copy."
"Copy, Chasna."
"Access Dome Central and shut down auto defenses on Thorview 12011. Immediate."
A pause.
"Shutdown authorized."
He made a step forward. I halted him and tossed a coin of my own. It bounced twice on the basalt terrace and rolled to a halt.
"I like to be sure," I said.
We came up either side of the main picture window. Fischig tried the slider, but it was locked. He stepped back, apparently preparing to shoot the window in. "It's armorplex," I told him, rapping my knuckles off the material. "Don't be stupid." I pulled the plastic bag containing Eichlone's effects from my jacket and searched for the compact las knife. Before I found it, I found the plastic key. Slim chances, but what the crud, as Inquisitor Hapshant used to say. I slid the key into the frame lock and the windows slid aside on motorized rails. We both waited. Perfumed air and light orchestral music wafted out past us.
"Adeptus Arbites, make yourself known," Fischig bellowed, his voice amplified by his helmet speaker.
They did. Rapid gunfire, heavy caliber, blew away the terrace rail, decapitated potted shrubs and dwarf trees, cropped flowerbeds, and chopped down the deck's aerial mast.
"Have it your way,"
bellowed Fischig, and he rolled in, pumping his shotgun. The blasts were deafening. I clambered up on a drain spout onto the second-level balcony, my shotgun dangling around my shoulders on its strap. Furious exchanges of fire rumbled below me. I went in through a gauze-draped opening into the main bedrooms. The room was overwarm and dark, dressed in red velvet with soothing ambient music welling from hidden vox speakers. The bed was in disarray. In one corner, on a gilt credenza, sat a portable vox set. I padded forward and studied the responder log. Fischig's chaos down below rumbled through the floor like a distant storm. The girl came out of a side room, a bathroom, I imagine, and shrieked when she saw me. She was naked and dived under the bedclothes for cover. The muzzle of my shotgun tracked her. "Who's here?" She whimpered and shook her head. "Inquisition," I hissed. "Who's here?" She began to sob and shook her head again. "Stay down. Get under the bed if you can." In the adjoining room I heard whistling. A voice called out a name. "Don't answer," I told the weeping girl. I moved slowly round to the side room door. Light shone out. There was a hint of steam and a smell of bath oils. The whistling had stopped. He was wary, I'll give him that. He didn't bluster out, gun blasting. I tipped open the door with the snout of my weapon, and five high-velocity rounds shredded holes in the wood panel. I fell to my belly on the floor and fired three shots in through the door gap. "Inquisition, throw down your weapon!" Two more shots punched through the door. I crawled backwards from the doorway and stood up, the gun resting in my hands. "Come out," I said, using my will. A large, tattooed, naked male blundered out of the bathroom, half his face shaved and half covered with sudsy foam. A Transvasa high-powered auto-pistol was still in one hand. "Put it down," I commanded. He hesitated, as if my will had no force. A conditioned mind, I supposed. Take no chances. The auto-pistol was just pulling up to find me when I blew off his half-shaved face with the shotgun and sent his body splintering back through the half-open door. The girl was still crouched, naked, at the end of the bed, shivering. I was surprised she hadn't bolted out of cover at my command, too. I spun to face her. "What's your name?"
"Lisa B."
"Full name," I snapped.
I wasn't concentrating on her, especially, but there was something about her. An air. A tone.
"Elizabeth Beckwin, pleasure girl. I worked the Sun Dome these past four dormants."
"You're here why?"
"They paid up front. Wanted a party. Oh, lords."
Her voice trailed away as she collapsed on the bed.
"Get dressed. Stay here. I will want to talk to you."
I moved to the door of the chamber and looked out into the unlit hall. Below, down the stairwell, gun flashes and shouts echoed up. Seeing my shape in the doorway, a man ran towards me.
"Wilk! Wilk! They've found us! They've—"
A moment before he realized I was not Wilk, I decked him with the butt of my weapon. He fell hard. Two solid shots raked the doorframe next to me. I ducked back in, sliding back the grip of the shotgun. Shots punched through the wall above the bedhead. Beckwin screamed and rolled off the bed. I blasted back, punching two more large holes in the door. Two men slammed into the room, wild-eyed and desperate. Both were dressed in light interior clothes. One had a las pistol, the other an auto-rifle. I dropped the las gunner with one direct shot that hurled his body against the wall. The man with the auto-rifle opened fire, his shots chewing through one of the bedposts. I dived for cover as the automatic fire ripped up tufts of carpet, shattered mirrors and demolished furnishings. Rolling, I frantically sought cover. My would-be killer dropped face down onto the bed. The girl pulled a long, retractable knife out of the back of his neck.
"I saved your life," she told me. "That'll make it better for me, right?"
I told the girl to stay put in the bedroom, and from her nod I was pretty sure she would. I stepped out into the gloomy hall. The level below had fallen silent.
"Fischig," I voxed. "Come down."
His reply crackled back. A spiral stairway led down into a large, split-level lounge area. The air was thick with smoke, which coiled out of the terrace window doors we had opened. The hard daylight of the sun dome streamed in, making ladder bars of light in the drifting haze. The opposite wall of the room was a wide, segmented shutter. If opened, it would reveal a view over the freezing wastes beyond the dome. A storm of gunfire had ruined the expensive furniture and decorative fittings. Five corpses lay twisted at various points on the floor. Fischig, his visor raised, was hauling a sixth man up into a high-backed chair. The man, wounded in the right shoulder, was wailing and crying. Fischig cuffed him into place.
"Upstairs?"
Fischig asked me without looking round. "Clear," I reported. I walked round the room, eyeing the dead and examining items left scattered on tabletops and bureau.
"I know some of these men," the chasener added, unsolicited. "Those two by the window. Locals. Low-grade labourers. Long list of petty convictions on both."
Hired muscle.
"Seems to be your man's way. The others are off-welders."
"You found papers?"
"No, it's just a hunch. None of them have got any ID or markers, and I haven't found a cache anywhere."
"What about this one?" I walked over to join him by the prisoner he had cuffed to the chair. The man coughed and whined, rolling his eyes. Unless he possessed unnaturally boosted strength, thanks to drugs or hidden augmetics, this man wasn't muscle. He was older, spare of frame, with grizzled salt-and-pepper growth on his chin.
"You didn't kill this one deliberately, did you?"
I asked Fischig. He smiled slightly, as if pleased that I had noticed.
I have rights,"
the man spat suddenly.
"You are in the custody of the Imperial Inquisition," I told him frankly. "You have no rights whatsoever."
He fell silent.
"Off-welder,"
Fischig said. I raised an eyebrow.
"Accent,"
Fischig explained. I'd never have detected it myself. This was one of the reasons I used local help whenever I got the chance, even a potential troublemaker like the Chastener. My work takes me from world to world, culture to culture. Slight differences in dialect or incongruities of slang regularly pass me by. But Fischig had heard it at once, and it made sense. If this was a leader rather than muscle, one of Eichlone's chosen lieutenants, then the odds were he was from off-world.
"Your name?" I asked.
"I will not answer."
"Then I will not have that wound treated for a while."
He shook his head. The wound was bad, and he was obviously in considerable pain. But he resisted. I was even more certain he was a ringleader. He was no longer shaking or whining. He had switched in some mental conditioning, no doubt taught by Eichlone. "Mind tricks won't help you," I said. "I'm much better at them than you are."
"Go screw yourself."
I glanced at Fischig out of courtesy.
"Brace yourself."
He stepped back.
"Tell me your name,"
I said, using my will. The man in the chair spasmed.
"Simon Krutz,"
he gasped.
"Godwin Fischig,"
spat the chastener involuntarily. He blushed and moved away, busying himself with a search.
"Very well, Simon Krutz. Where are you from?"
I didn't employ any will now. In my experience, it took only one blow to loosen mental defences.
"Thracian Primaris."
"What was your job there?"
"I was trade envoy for the Bonded Merchant Guild of Synesius."
I knew the name. Guild Synesius was one of the largest mercantile companies in the sector. It had holdings on 100-plus planets and links to the Imperial nobility. It also, as Betancourt had informed me just that morning, had a trade launch berthed at the Sundome landing stage.
"And what work brought you to Hubris?"
"That same work, as a trade envoy."
"In dormant?"
"There is always trade to be had. Long-term contracts with the authorities on this world that require the personal touch."
"And if I contact your guild, will it confirm this?"
"Of course."
I walked around behind him.
"So what brought you here?"
"To these private apartments?"
"I was a guest."
"Of who?"
"Namber Wilk, a local trader. He invited me for a mid-dormant feast."
"This dwelling is registered to Namber Wilk," Fischig put in.
"A trader, as he says, no priors. I don't know him."
"What about Eichlone?" I asked Krutz, leaning down to stare into his eyes. There was a ripple of fear in them.
"Who?"
Your real employer. Murdin Eichlone. Don't make me ask you again.
I don't know any Eichlone.
There was a ring of truth to his voice. He may well not have known Eichlone by that name. I dragged up a chair and sat down facing him. There is an awful lot of your story that doesn't add up. You're found here consorting with recidivists who we can connect to a planetary conspiracy. There are charges of murder to be considered, a lot of them. We can continue this in far more intimate and comprehensive circumstances, or you can make me like you more by filling in some details now.
I don't know what to tell you.
Whatever you know. About the Pontius, perhaps. A dark, stricken look crossed his face. His jaw worked for a moment, trying to form words. He quivered. Then there was a liquid pop, and his head fell forward.
"Throne of Light!" Fischig cried.
"Damn it!" I growled, and bent down to lift Croat's limp skull. He was dead. Eichlone had left failsafes in the conditioning that would trigger at certain subjects. The Pontius evidently was one of those. A stroke. Artificially induced.
So we know nothing.
We know a great deal. Weren't you listening? For a start, we know the Pontius is the most precious secret they protect.
So tell me about it.
I was about to, at least evasively, when the shutter barring the far wall to the climate extremes of the world outside the dome blew out. Hidden charges fired simultaneously. The metal sheet splayed outwards into the freezing dark. The blast force threw both Fischig and myself to the ground. A millisecond later, the shattered crystal in the portal blew back in at us, carried by the hurricane power of the dormant winds outside, a blizzard of billions of razor-sharp slivers. Chapter 5 Covered Traces. The Glaws of Gudrun. Unwelcome Companions. Deafened by the blast, I had wit enough left to grab Fischig and roll with him out through the terraced doors as the emergency shutter clanked down from its slit in the hardwood ceiling. We lay panting and half-blind on the terrace, the hard light and warmth of the sun dome thawing our cold-shocked bodies. Alarms and warning bells sounded all along the Thorview residences. Our BT's units were already on their way. We got up. Our clothes and simple good fortune had protected us from the worst of the glass storm, though I had a gash straight down my left cheek that would need closing, and Fischig had a long splinter of glass embedded in his thigh between armor joints. Apart from that, we had just superficial scratches.
"Bad timing?"
he asked, though he knew it wasn't. The charges were set off by the same spasm that killed Croats. He glanced away and rebuckled one of his gauntlets, giving himself time to think. His face was a dingy grey colour, mainly through shock, but I think he was now beginning to understand the resources and capabilities of the people we worked against. Their abominable crime at Processional 212 had demonstrated the scale of their malice, but he hadn't seen that firsthand. Now he was witnessing the fanatical servants of a dark cause, men who would fight without hesitation to the death. And he had seen how brutally they would cover their traces, using mental weapons and brain-wired booby traps that spoke of vast resources and frightening sophistication. RBT's squads moved into the dwelling and secured it while local Medicaid servitors patched our wounds. The clearance squads brought out the shivering girl, Bequin. She was wrapped in blankets and her face was pinched blue with cold. Under my seal and instruction, they placed her in custody. She was too cold to voice a complaint. Fischig and I re-entered wearing heat gowns. It would be another 2 or 3 hours before engineer teams could replace the outer shutter. From the harsh light of the terrace, we passed through 3 hastily hung insulation curtains into the dim, blue twilight of the apartment. The far wall was gone, and we looked directly into the clear, glassy night of Hubris, a glossy grey landscape of stark shadows and backscattered light stretching away from the edge of the sun dome. Once more I was exposed to the piercing cold of dormant, and my blood ached. The main room where we had questioned Croats was a gutted cavity, blackened by soot and jewelled with glass. Hard lacquers of frost caked furniture surfaces and twisted the faces of the dead. Blood spilt by the shredding storm of glass was crusted like rubies in the dark. We played the smoky white beams of our lamps around. I doubted we would find much now. There was a good chance any valuable documents had been set to burn or delete on the same trigger signal that had blown the shutter and killed Croats. And it also seemed likely these people carried all truly important information internally, as memory engrams or meme codes, the sort of techniques usually reserved for the higher echelons of diplomatic corps, the administratum and elite trade delegations. That turned my mind back to Croats's employer, the Guild Synesias.
"It's a common enough name in this subsector," Amos told me back in the comfortable half-light of the gun cutter in its landing platform berth. He had been researching the name Pontius. "I've turned up over 500,000 citizens with that forename, another 200,000 with it as a middle name, plus another 40,000 or 50,000 spelling variants."
He waved a data slate at me. I brushed it aside and used a hand mirror to study the line of metal butterfly sutures in the wound in my cheek. "What about the definite article?"
"I have over 9,000 marks with that connection," he sighed.
He began to read them from his slate list.
"The Pontius Swellwyn Youth Academy. The Pontius Praxiteles Translation Bureau. The Pontius Guyvant Ropus Investment Financiary. The Pontius Spiegel Microsurgical Hospital."
"Enough," I sat at the codifier, typing in name groups. Flickering runes hunted and darted across the viewplate. Text extracts drifted into focus. I searched through them by eye, my finger resting on the scroll bar. "Pontius Glore," I said. He blinked and looked at me. There was a half-smile of scholarly delight on his narrow face.
"Not on my lists."
"Because he is dead?"
"Because he's dead."
Amos came over and looked across my shoulder at the screen.
"But it makes a sort of sense."
It did. A kind of illogic that had the flavour of truth. The sort of spore an inquisitor gets a nose for after a few years. The Glore family was old blood, a thrusting noble dynasty that had been a main player in this subsector for almost a millennium. The primary familial holdings and estates were on Gudrun, a world that had already come to our attention. House Glore was also a major shareholder and investor in the regal bonded merchant guild of Synesias, so the codifier had just revealed to me. "Pontius Glore," I murmured. Pontius Glore had been dead for more than 200 years. The seventh son of Oberon Glore, one of the great patriarchs of that line. He had suffered the fate of most junior siblings in that there had been precious little for him to inherit once his older brothers had taken their turn. His eldest brother, another Oberon, had become lord of the house. The second eldest had been gifted with the control of the stock holdings. The third had taken on the captaincy of the house militia. The fourth and fifth had married politically and entered the administratum at high level. And so it went. From what I remembered of Pontius Glore's biography, required reading as a trainee, Pontius had become a dilettante, wasting his life, his robust virility, charisma, and finely educated intellect in all manner of worthless pursuits. He had gambled away a significant measure of his personal fortune, then rebuilt it on the revenues of slave trading and pit fighting. A ruthless sliver of brutality stained his record. And then, in his 40s, with his health ruined by years of abuse, he turned to a much darker path. It has always been suspected that this turn was triggered by some chance event, an artifact or document that fell into his hands, perhaps the strange beliefs of some of the more barbaric pit fighters he enslaved. Instinct told me the propensity had always been within him, and that he was looking for a chance to let it flourish. It is documented he was a lifelong collector of rare and often prohibited books. At what point might his appetite for licentious and esoteric pornography have spilled over into the heretical and blasphemous? Pontius Glore became a disciple of chaos, a devotee of the most abominable and obscene forces that haunt this galaxy. He drew a coven around him, and over a period of 15 years committed unspeakable and increasingly brazen acts of evil. He was slain eventually, his coven along with him, on Lamsarot, by an inquisitorial purge led by the great Absalon Angevin. House Glore participated in this overthrow, desperate to be seen to distance themselves from his crimes. It is likely this alone prevented the entire family from being pulled down with him. A monster, a notorious monster, and dead, as Amos had been so quick to point out, dead for more than 2 centuries. But the name and the connection of facts seemed too obvious to ignore. I wandered up to the cockpit and sat with Betancourt. "We'll need passage off-world, to Gudrun."
"I'll arrange it. It may be a day or two."
"As fast as you can." I sent word to High Custodian Carpel, informing him of some, though not all, of my findings, and telling him I would shortly be leaving to continue my investigations on Gudrun. I was reading through the confidential case records of Inquisitor Angevin when 2 Arbites brought Bequin to my gun cutter. I had sent orders for her to be delivered into my charge. She stood in the crew bay, frowning in the gloom, cuffed. She had dressed in a tawdry gown and a light cloak, but despite the cheapness of her garb and the discomfort she was in, her considerable beauty was plain to see. Good bones, a full mouth, fierce eyes and long dark hair. Yet, again, there was that air about her, that tone I had detected before. Despite her obvious physical attractions, there was something almost repellent about her. It was curious, but I was convinced I knew what it was. She glanced round as I entered the crew bay, her expression a mix of fear and indignation.
"I helped you," she spat.
"You did, though I neither asked for nor needed your help." She pouted. That air was stronger now, an unpleasant feeling that made me want to bundle her out of the cutter and have done with her there and then.
"The Arbites say they will charge me with murder and conspiracy."
"The Arbites desperately want someone to pin the crimes on. You are unhappily involved in those matters, though I don't believe deliberately."
"Damn right," she snarled. "This has ruined me, my life here, just when I was getting things together."
"Your life has been difficult." She fixed me with a sneer that questioned my intelligence. "I'm a pleasure girl, an object," it seemed to say. "Lowest of the low. How difficult do you think my life has been?" I stepped forward and removed the Arbites' cuffs. She rubbed her wrists and looked at me in surprise. "Sit down," I told her. I was using the will. She looked at me again, as if wondering what the funny tone was all about, and then calmly took a seat on a padded leather bench along the crew bay's back wall. "I can make sure the charges are dropped," I told her. "I have that authority. Indeed, my authority is the only reason you haven't been charged or interrogated so far."
"Why would you do that?"
"I thought you believed I owed you."
"Doesn't matter what I believe."
There was a sullen cast to her face as she looked me up and down. I found myself intrigued. Objectively, I was looking at a girl whose looks and vivacious spirit made her undeniably desirable. Yet I
almost wanted to shout at her, to drive her away, to get her out of my sight. I had an entirely unwarranted and instinctive loathing for her. "Even if you clear me, I can't carry on here. They'll hound me out. I'll be marked as trouble. That'll be the end of my work. I'll have to move on again."
She stared down at the floor and muttered a curse.
"Just when I was getting it together."
"Move on. You're not from Hubris."
"This miserable shit pit."
"Where then?"
"I came here from Thracian Primaris, 4 years ago.
"You were born on Thracian?"
She shook her head. "Bonaventure."
That was half a sector away. "How did you get from Bonaventure to Thracian?"
"By way of this and that, here and there. I've travelled a lot. Never stayed put very long."
"Because things get difficult."
The sneer again. "That's right. I'd stuck it out here longer than anywhere. Now that's all screwed up."
"Stand up," I snapped suddenly, using the will again. She paused and shrugged at me.
"Make your mind up."
She got to her feet. "I want to ask you some questions about the men who employed you at Thorview 12011.
"I thought you might."
"If you answer helpfully, I can cut you a deal."
"What sort of deal?"
"I can take you to Gudrun, give you a chance to make a new start. Or I can offer you employment, if you're interested." She smiled quizzically. It was the first positive expression I had seen on her. It made her more beautiful, but I didn't like her any better.
"Employment? You'd employ me? An inquisitor would employ me?"
"That's right. Certain services I think you can provide." She took 2 fluid steps over to me and placed her hands flat against my chest.
I see, she said. Even big bad inquisitors have needs, huh? That's fine.
You misunderstand, I replied, pushing her back as politely as I could. Physical contact with her made the unnatural feeling of revulsion even stronger. The services I have in mind will be new to you, not the sort of work you are accustomed to. Are you still interested? She set her head on one side and considered me.
You're an odd one, all right. Are all inquisitors like you?
No. I ordered the servitor Modo to provide her with refreshment and left her in the crew bay. Betancourt was stood in the shadows outside the door, gazing in at her appreciatively.
"She's a fine sight," he murmured to me, as if I might not have noticed.
"You forget Vibben so quickly."
He snapped round at me, stung. "That was low, Eisenhorn. I was just commenting."
"You'll like her less when you get to know her. She's an untouchable."
"Seriously?"
"Seriously. A psychic blank. It's natural, and I haven't tested her limits. It's all I can do to be in the same room as her."
"Such a looker, too,"
Betancourt sighed, gazing back in at her. "Useful to us. If she passes certain requirements, I'm going to employ her." He nodded. Untouchables were rare and almost impossible to create artificially. They have a negative presence in the warp that renders them virtually immune to psychic powers, which in turn makes them potent anti-psycho weapons. The side effect of their psychic blankness is the unpleasant disturbance that accompanies them, the waves of fear and revulsion they trigger in those they meet. No wonder her life had been difficult and friendless.
News? I asked Betancourt.
Made contact with a sprint trader called the SN. Masters one Tobias Maxilla. Deals in small units of luxury goods. Coming here in 2 days to deliver a consignment of vintage wines from Hesperus, then on to Gudrun. For a fee, he'll make room for the cutter in his hold.
Good work. So we'll be on Gudrun when?
2 weeks.
I spent the next hour or so interviewing Beckwin, but as I suspected, she knew precious little about any of the men. We gave her accommodation in a small bunk cell next to Betancourt's quarters. It was scarcely more than a box, and Nilquit had to remove piles of stowed equipment to clear it. But she seemed pleased enough. When I asked her if she had any possessions she wished to collect from the Sundome, she simply shook her head. I was reviewing yet more piles of data with Amos when Fischig arrived. He was dressed in his brown serge uniform suit and carried 2 bulky holdalls over his shoulder, which he dropped to the deck with a declamatory thump as he stepped aboard. "To what do I owe this visit, Chasner?" I asked. He showed me a slate bearing Carpel's official seal.
"The High Custodian grants you permission to leave to pursue your inquiry. Dependent on this."
I reviewed the slate and sighed.
"I'm coming with you," he said.
Chapter 6 Divination by Auto-Seance. A Dream. Joining the SN. I lodged a formal complaint with the High Custodian's office, but it was simply for show. Carpel could manufacture serious problems for me if I tried to leave without his agent. I could do that, of course. I could do as I liked. But Carpel could delay me, and I didn't know how much cooperation from the elders and administrations of Hubris I'd need later if any part of this investigation led to trial. Besides, Carpel knew I was going on to Gudrun, and he would plainly send Fischig there under an RBT's warrant to investigate anyway. On the whole, I decided I'd rather have Chasner Fischig where I could see him. On the afternoon before our intended departure, I had Loing prepare for an auto-seance. I doubted whether anything further could be learned now, but I wanted to cover every avenue. As usual, we used my quarters, with the cabin door locked, and Betancourt strictly instructed to prevent interruptions. I sat in a high-back armchair and spent some quarter of an hour lowering my mind to a semi-trance state. This was an old technique, one of the first I had been taught when my abilities had originally been detected by the tutors of the Inquisition. On a cloth-covered table between us, Loink laid out key evidence items, some of Iclone's effects, some other pieces taken from Thorview 12011, and some from the processional. We also had the mysterious casket from the cryogenerator chamber.
Once he was satisfied I was ready, Loink opened his mind to the warp and filtered its raging influence through his highly trained mental architecture. This transitional moment was always a shock, and I shuddered. The temperature in the room dropped palpably, and a glass bowl on a side counter cracked spontaneously. Loink was murmuring. His eyes rolled back, twitching and jerking slightly. I closed my eyes, though I could still see my room. What I was seeing was a visualization of our surroundings, constructed by Loink astropathically in the Empyrean itself. Everything shone with a pale blue light from within, and solids became translucent. The dimensions of the room shifted slightly, stretching and buckling as if they had difficulty retaining their coherence. I took up the items on the table in turn, Loink's projection enhancing their psychometric qualities, opening my mind's ability to the signatures and resonances they carried in the warp. Most were dull and blunt, with no trace of resonance. Some had wispy tendrils of auras around them, relics of passing contact with human hands and human minds. Iclone's Vox device buzzed with the distant, unintelligible whinings of ghosts, but gave up nothing. Iclone's pistol stung my hand like a scorpion when I touched it, and both I and Loink gasped. I had a brief aftertaste of death. I decided not to touch it again. His data slate, which Amos had yet been unable to open, was dripping with a sticky, almost gelatinous aura. The thickness of the psychic residue betokened the complex thought processes and data that had adhered to it. It gave up nothing, and I became frustrated. Loink amplified my scrutiny, and at last, as a whisper, I landed the word or name, Desumnor. The final item for inspection was the casket. It resonated brightly with flickering bands of warp traces. Our contact with it was necessarily brief because of the exhausting strength of its halo. We probed, opening what seemed to be three levels of psychometric activity. One was sharp and hard and tasted of metal. Loink averred that this was a relic of the intellect or intellects that had crafted the casket, an undeniably brilliant but malevolent presence. Beneath that, colder, smaller, denser, like a lightless collapsed star, lay a heavy, throbbing trace that seemed to be locked in the heart of the casket's machine core. Around both, fluttering and swooping like birds, were the vestigial psychic agonies of the dead from Processional 212. Their plaintive psychic noise rippled through our thoughts and sapped the emotional strength from us both. The dead souls of the Processional had left their psychic fingerprints on this device that had been instrumental in their murder. We were about to step back and end the seance when the second trace, the cold, distant, dense one, began to well up to the surface. I was intrigued at first, then stunned by its gathering force and speed. It filled my head with a nauseating, intolerable sense of hunger. Hunger, thirst, appetite, craving. It rose from the depths of the casket, wailing and yearning, a dark thing tearing up through the other trace energies. I glimpsed its malice and felt its consuming need. Loink broke the link. He slumped back in his seat, panting, his skin dotted with the stigmatic blood spots of an astropathic augury taken too far. I felt it too. My mind seemed cold, colder even than the ministrations of dormant. It seemed to take a very long time before my thoughts began to flow freely again, like water slowly thawing in an iced pipe. I rose and poured myself a glass of Amasek. I poured one for Loink, too, as an afterthought. Neither of us ever came away from an auto-seance feeling good, but this was signally worse than usual.
"There was danger,"
Loink husked at last.
"Vile danger, from the casket."
I felt it.
"But the whole seance was unseemly, Master, as if distracted and spoiled by some factor."
I sighed. I knew what he had felt. I can explain. "The girl we have aboard is an untouchable." Loink shuddered.
"Keep her away from me."
I passed the word Desumnor to Amos in case it assisted his work on the data slate and rested in my cabin to recover. Loink had gone back to his tiny residence under the cockpit deck. I doubted he would be useful for much for a goodly while. I gathered up the evidence items, rebagged them, and locked them in the cutter's strongbox, all except the casket, which was too big to fit.
We kept it bagged and chained in a tarpaulin locker aft. As I hefted it up to return it to the locker, I felt the aftershock of its aura, as if we had woken something, some instinct. I considered this to be the imagination of my stung mind working overtime, but I completed the task only when I had buckled on a pair of work gloves. Betancourt joined me shortly afterwards. He had gone through Vibben's effects and found no will or instructions. Now we needed her cabin to house Fischig, so we placed her belongings and clothes in an underseat store bin in the crew bay, and together carried her wrapped body to the cot in the medical suite. I locked the door as we left.
"What will you do with her?" Betancourt asked. "There's no time to arrange a burial here now."
"She once said she came with me to see what the stars were like. That's where we'll lay her to rest." Then I slept, turning fitfully despite my exhaustion. When sleep finally came, the dreams were cold and inhospitable. Murderously black, backlit clouds rippled in fast motion across skies I didn't know, strobing with electrical flashes. Dark trees and darker, higher walls ranged around the edges of the dream. I felt the instinct, the hunger from the casket, lurking in some blind spot my eyes refused to find. Carrion birds, a flock of them, swooped down from the upper reaches of the sky and took all the colour with them, staining the dream world grey, all except for a spot of red that glittered in the colourless soil ahead of me. With each step I took towards it, it receded. I began to run. It continued to display dream logic and moved away. Finally, gasping for breath, I stopped running. The red spot had gone. I felt the hunger again, but now it was inside me, clawing at my belly, filling my throat with craving. The roiling clouds overhead froze suddenly, motionless, even the lightning flares stilled and captured in jagged, phosphorescent lines. A voice spoke my name. I thought it was Vibben, but when I turned, there was nothing to see except the suggestion of a presence drifting away like smoke. I woke. From the clock, I had been asleep only a couple of hours. My throat was raw, and my mouth dry. I drained two glasses of water from the side cabinet and then fell back on the bed. My head ached, but my mind would not stop spinning. After that, no sleep came at all. The Voxlink chimed about 4 hours later. It was Betancourt.
"The SN has just made orbit," he told me. "We can leave whenever you like."
The SN lay slantwise above the inverted bowl of Hubris, silhouetted against the stars. We had left the radiance of the sun dome into a blizzard squall. The airframe of the cutter had vibrated wildly as Betancourt lifted us out of the clutches of the ferocious icy winds until we were riding clear over an ocean of frosty vapour. The blizzard, a sculptural white continent, then dropped away below until we could see its tides and gusts and currents, the wide centrifugal patterns of its titanic force.
"There,"
Betancourt had said, with a nod to the raked front ports. Even at 90 kilometres, still rising through the thinning aeropores, he had made visual contact. It had taken me a few more moments to find it. A bar of darkness distorting the pearly edge of the planesphere. Another minute, and it had become a three-dimensional solid. A minute more, and I began to resolve the running lights glittering on its surface. Yet another minute, and it filled the ports. It resembled some colossal tower that had been ripped away from its earthly foundations and set adrift, tranquil, in the void.
"A beauty,"
murmured Betancourt, who appreciated such things. His inlaid hands flicked over the flight controls, and we yawed to the correct approach vectors. The gun cutter and the massive vessel exchanged automatic telemetry chatter. The flight deck picked plates were alive with columns of rushing data.
"A bulk clipper of the classic Isolde pattern, from the depot yards of Urhaven, or Tancred. Majestic,"
Amos was muttering, and annotating his idle observations into his wrist slate again. The SN was 3 kilometres long, by my estimation, and fully 700 metres deep at its broadest part. Its nose was a long, sleek cone, like a cathedral spire, made of overlapping Gothic curves and barbed with bronze finials and spines. Behind that bladed front, the angular hull thickened into muscular buttresses of rusty red plating, looped and riveted with ribs of dark steel.
Crenellated tower stacks bulged from the dorsal hump. 100-meter masts stabbed forward from the hull like tusks, and other, shorter masts projected from the flanks and underside, winking with guide lights. The rear portion of the juggernaut splayed into four heat-blackened cones, each of which was large enough to swallow a dozen gun-cutters at once. Betancourt turned us in and ran us along the flank, heading aft. To us, the great vessel seemed to wallow and roll as we joined its horizontal. A lighted dot divorced itself from the SN and ran out ahead of us, flashing ultra-bright patterns of red and green lamps, a pilot drone to lead us in. Betancourt gently chased the drone and swung to port as its lights instructed. We slid neatly between two mast arrays, crossed the ribbed belly, and finally braked to station keeping under a rectangular belly hatch edged with black and yellow chevrons. The hatch was one of a line of six down the hull's underside, but this was the only open one. A fiery orange glow washed down over us. Exchanging a few terse comments with Euclid in the drive room, Betancourt nudged the gun cutter upwards through the yawning hatch. I watched the edges of the hatch mouth, 2 meters thick and scratched in places to the bare metal, pass by alarmingly close. There followed a series of gentle shudders,